Hi everyone, Mel Teller-Seekin here for episode number 52. I'm not sure you're aware, but all of our interviews are typically done at a distance. So I'm sitting in my office with my recording equipment and my guest is wherever they are in the world with theirs. And from time to time, I get the great opportunity to meet with people face to face. And for today's interview, that's what I got to do. And we went to a place in the Brisbane City area, Brisbane CBD, called The Corner Office. And I want to tell you about them, not only because I really enjoy the service and I like the location, but they have actually come on as show sponsors. So any of my face-to-face interviews that I get to do in Brisbane will be done at their offices. And I want to tell you a little bit about them because they have a really unique offering. It's a very smart location where they have a selection of meeting rooms that you can use. They hold from 3 to 6 people right through to boardrooms for up to 10 to 20 participants. They also have a very smart co-sharing workspace with high-speed Wi-Fi and a fully licensed lounge bar. The Corner Office is also ideal for holding private corporate functions for client appreciation. Product presentations or even cocktail parties are something that they organize for you. They have an experienced team that will coordinate all your meetings or function requirements, and they really do know how to deliver exceptional customer service. I met Sam on the day that we interviewed, so they really do a fantastic job. The meeting rooms are all named after international business districts. For today's interview, we were in the Central District of Hong Kong meeting room with a view overlooking Adelaide Street in the CBD. The Corner Office has business owners and managers using the Corner Office for their business requirements as they need it or on a regular basis to get work done as a member. The best way to see what they can do for your business is actually to visit them, or you can visit their website at thecorneroffice.club. That's thecorneroffice.club.
You're listening to the Customer Centric Show with Mel Teller-Seekin, where we talk with successful business owners and experts to share smart ways to attract more customers, profits, and freedom by thinking about customers first. Now, here's your host, Mel Teller-Seekin.
Hello, and thanks for joining me for another episode. Today, I invited this guest on the show because I regularly read her posts on LinkedIn around leadership, productive workplace culture, and mindfulness in business. As the director of PAC Executive Human Capital, Shalina Ord leads a team of coaches and human capital specialists who consult to an impressive list of leading executives and corporate companies globally. Shalina calls herself a business builder, and over the last 20 years, she's worked at organisations like Mercer, building out their internal talent acquisition team, and for consulting groups like Profusion Group, establishing new teams in new markets and cities. Shalina is a regular contributor to business journals like the CEO Magazine, Business Women's Media, Business Insider, even Koshy's Business Builders, and she's looking forward to releasing her first book, The Mindful Work Week, in the latter half of this year. Today we're meeting face-to-face, which is really nice, at the Corner Office in Brisbane City and the sponsor of today's show. So it's great to be doing face-to-face here,
yeah,
having this interview.
Loving it. And it's a great space as well.
It's lovely, isn't it?
I think I'll be coming back here for myself.
Oh, very good. Now, we always kick off the show by asking people for examples of who they consider to be a customer-centric business.
Mm-hmm.
So
yes.
What are you thinking?
Have you heard of Zappos before?
I have.
Yeah. Are you sick of hearing about Zappos?
No. Let's talk about Zappos because they're outstanding.
Yes. So. Yeah, absolutely. So I think it's very relevant to the work that I do, because what I do is I teach people how to be productive and happy. So the Zappos culture focuses on delivering happiness, and that's why I really resonate with that brand. They focus on three things in terms of the way that they run their business. First, it's about culture, about the people.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, it's about customers. And thirdly, it's about pipeline. And what they mean by pipeline is developing their talent so that everyone in their organization has a successor and their successor has a successor. So when someone's promoted or when someone leaves, they already have someone who can slot into that next position as well. And they're very protective of their culture, their values, and really making sure that they only hire people who want to get the best possible outcomes for their clients.
Mm.
So that's, it just says it all, really.
Yeah, they're fantastic. They're essentially an online retailer, aren't they?
Yes.
And I recently, over the holidays, actually reread Tony Hsieh's book, Delivering Happiness.
Yes.
And it's outstanding. Like, it's really worth the read if people haven't gotten into it, because even if you're not in retail, it's just an amazing insight into how they've created the culture
Absolutely.
That they have, and to get everyone so on board.
Yeah.
It's
and the way that he writes the book as well, he's quite, he's very humble.
Yes.
He has great ideas, but he just explains them as if they kind of all fell into place.
Even though
he worked very hard,
it's almost autobiographical to start off with for a while, isn't it? It feels like half the book is like that, and it's like, get to the meaty stuff. And it's like, but no, it all makes sense as you read.
Yeah, it all comes together. And the most important content and message in the book is actually almost the last paragraph, where he talks about what happiness means to him and how they measure happiness. And I think I actually bought the book thinking that that's what it would all be about. But, it's definitely worth a read.
It is. It really, really is. And I actually listened to it through the audio, Audible.
Yes.
And it was great because it had those extra snippets to it that you don't necessarily get in the book version. So,
yeah. I'm addicted to Audible.
It's fantastic. Great. Now, let's talk about who you are and how you ended up coming to this role. So, can you explain what human capital is?
Yes.
Give us the rundown.
Yeah, well, essentially human capital just basically means your resource, your human resources, the people, and the professional development that you give to those people. So, again, if we were to describe an organisation like Zappos, where they have a particular culture and particular values, and they hire people with those values, so they already represent those values. However, they need certain skills to work. And what my company does is we teach people how to work. So if you think about all the professional development you've had in your life, you went to school, you went to high school, you went to university. Most of us have been privy to some kind of leadership or customer service training. But very few of us actually learn how to work or are taught how to work. You learn through trial and error. And sometimes that's good.
That makes sense.
Yeah, and sometimes that's good, but sometimes the solutions we come up with or the strategies that we come up with actually don't lead to productivity, and they actually don't lead to happiness. And therefore, we end up unhappy at work, and we end up wasting our time, and then we become unproductive, and it kind of spirals from there.
Okay, so when you talk about starting off with values, so you can bring people in ideally that way first, so common values, so that you're all coming sort of reading from the same songbook, I guess, and then from there, people would normally come into a workplace and sort of find their feet by mirroring somebody else, perhaps. You're talking about, is it creating systems and processes to be able to do that, or?
I actually focus in on habits.
Habits.
So 40 to 45% of the decisions we make each day are simply due to habit. And within your business, within your team, the work that you do is essentially a whole heap of habits. So when you teach someone in those first 90 days when they come in, you're teaching them the team habits. You know, this is how we make coffee. And soon it becomes just a habit that you do very easily. This is how we serve a customer. This is how we look across a restaurant to make sure the customers are being taken care of. So when you go into, say, as an example, into a restaurant, you can sit back and view the habits of the staff, and you'll be able to observe whether they have very good habits or whether they have habits that are actually turning your clients away.
Right.
So now, in terms of what I teach people, though, I teach people how to develop those habits. So together we might identify, okay, well, how are you wasting time? How are you using your resources? How are you insert whatever here? We work out what the current habit is. We work out, and I, of course, have quite a few good suggestions on what the good habit should be. And then together in our coaching programs, I help the client to develop the good habits over time, and then do it in a sustainable way. And I like to give the example when I'm training people of diets because, you know,
yes.
I've been on them quite a few times.
Yeah.
And that's all around habits too, you know. We all know what we should be eating, though we don't necessarily eat those foods. And it's a question of developing good, healthy eating habits. And it's the same in the work environment as well.
Okay, so I'm thinking that you walk into a workplace and mm-hmm. you're observing. Let's say you're a business owner and you're looking at your team and you can see where those habits are causing issues for you.
Yes.
Is that why a third party is worth bringing into the fold? Because it's difficult to do that as a leader sometimes to mm-hmm. be able to implement that change? Or is it that sometimes we can't see those habits because we're in it?
Yeah. What do you find? It could absolutely be both of those. The work that I do, people can do for themselves.
Yeah.
I gave the diet example. Yep. We could all go on a diet ourselves, but it's actually better if you go to a personal trainer because the personal trainer holds you accountable.
Sure.
And that's essentially what I do. And as you know, I produce a lot of writing.
Yes.
And I give away my content constantly.
Yeah.
But most of the people who read that content don't actually apply it. So that's where the coaching comes in.
Yes.
Sometimes it's that you don't know you should be doing that, but most of the time most people know what they should be doing. They're just not doing them because they haven't learned how to develop the habit.
And they're not perhaps making that the priority.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so let's say if people were to look at the habits that their team have and they're able to identify those, what sort of processes do they go through to be able to make that shift?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's talk about the habit loop. I think that's extremely important. If you're looking at changing your habits, the best way to describe it is to ask people to actually draw it, right? So imagine a triangle. At the top of the triangle is a trigger. So before we do any kind of behaviour, there's something that triggers that behaviour. So I gave the example of making coffee before.
Mm-hmm.
A client orders a coffee or a customer orders a coffee. The next thing that happens is the actual action. So that's the habit or the behaviour. So that's at the bottom right-hand side of the triangle.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next thing that happens is there's a reward. So I've been taught how to make coffee in the most efficient and effective way. The reward is I produce this beautiful, you know, skinny chai latte, whatever it is mm-hmm. the client yeah. wants or customer wants, and hand it over to the customer. The reward may be different, well, will be different for everyone. So the reward for me might be just seeing that beautiful coffee and presenting it to the customer, so it's my sense of pride. Or the reward might be when I can see the customer enjoying what I've provided them. Now, when you're looking at changing a habit, you need to understand what's the trigger and what's the reward. Now, I told you I talk about weight loss a lot because I think we can all relate to that. So an example that I give all the time is I love chocolate
mm-hmm.
and I love Haig's chocolate.
You love which?
Haig's chocolate. Can you get Haig's chocolate in Brisbane?
Yes, yeah.
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 So, and because I live in Melbourne, there's Haig's chocolate at every corner. So mm-hmm. So when I first moved to Melbourne, I used to eat a lot of Haig's chocolate. Now, my trigger would be that I ate something savoury. And the habit would, of course, be I'd walk down to Haig's, I'd buy myself a Haig's chocolate, never just a little one, a big one, and they give you a sample, so, you know, double whammy.
Mm-hmm.
And then the reward would be when I finally ate it, I had that sweet sensation.
Yes.
Now, after putting on 15 kilos, I realised that this had to stop, right?
Mm-hmm.
So let's look at the habit loop. The trigger, when I have something savoury, is still going to be there. Now, instead of going to Haig's, I have fruit. And the reward is the same. So the trigger is that I have something savoury.
Is it really, though?
Well, it is for me.
It is.
But for someone else, it might be different, which is the trick. Because when you're looking to change a habit, you need to experiment and understand what's that trigger. We all know what the habit is, but what's the reward that I get? Because sometimes I don't eat chocolate because I've had something savoury. I eat chocolate because I've had a bad day.
Mm-hmm.
I want that sense of nurturing that I get. It takes me back to my childhood when my parents would give me something sweet, which didn't happen all the time, right?
Mm. Yes.
Now we can have chocolate whenever we want, but when we were kids it was only at certain times.
Yeah.
So when I eat that chocolate, I feel nurtured and nourished. So if I'm in that place where I'm about to go and have Hague's, and I still let myself have Hague's every now and then, I might say, well, instead of eating that chocolate, I know that the reward is that I need to feel nurtured. Why don't I call my mum instead? Or why don't I call a friend? Or, so you've got to experiment with the trigger and the reward. And that's where you were, I think you were getting to before. You wanted to understand what I do differently to what a normal manager might do.
Yes.
Yep. Normally, if you're looking to change a habit, you just focus on the action. But what we focus on is identifying the trigger and the reward, and that's what makes it sustainable.
So it's thinking through the whole process.
Exactly.
All right, so let's talk about mindfulness in business.
Yeah.
So can we first of all, can you explain what mindfulness looks like in business and the benefit?
Yeah. Do you mind if I tell a story?
Oh, I'd love a story, absolutely.
This is a story I tell at the start of my mindfulness workshop sometimes. But it's the story, and you've probably seen it because I know you've read some of my articles, but it's the story of the elephant and the five blind monks. So in ancient India, there were five blind monks and an elephant, and the five blind monks were trying to determine what an elephant is because they'd never seen it. They'd all been blind since birth.
Mm-hmm.
So they're touching the elephant, and they're all at different places in the elephant, right? So one's at the tail, and he feels the tail, and it feels like a rope, and he said, you know, this is quite sinewy, it feels quite like rope, therefore an elephant is a rope. And then the other one of the other blind monks is at the ear, and he's feeling the ear, and he's saying, actually this feels quite expansive, it's a lot like a fan, therefore an elephant is a fan. Another blind monk was feeling the trunk, and he's feeling the trunk, and he says, actually, this feels quite like the limb of a tree, therefore an elephant is a tree.
Mm-hmm.
The other two blind monks came up with similar stories. One thought it was a trunk or perhaps a pillar. The other thought perhaps it's a spear. Now, I use this story to describe mindfulness because most of us are like those blind monks. The way that we interact with the world and our customers is based on the information we have at the time. And there's always a different story. There's always more to it. So sometimes we're the blind monk and we're making a judgment and a decision and then behaving in a way that may not be appropriate because we're only focusing on one small piece of the information. We're reacting rather than responding.
Mm.
Now, sometimes we're the blind monk and sometimes we're the elephant. Sometimes we're the one who we're interacting with a customer and the customer is the blind monk. They're thinking that we are a particular way. They think we're a spear and actually we're a fan or actually we're an elephant.
Mm.
But this is where mindfulness comes into play because it teaches us to sit back and reflect, to observe the reality as it is. So we become present and we become less fixed on judgment and more fixed on observation. Now we may never see the full elephant. There's always something hidden that we don't see, but we're able to sit back, reflect and respond rather than react. It also gives us the opportunity if when we're in that position where we are the elephant versus the blind monk, when we are being misunderstood, again to sit back, take a moment and reflect and observe and again respond and help that customer understand our way and our view a little better. Now that's my view on how mindfulness helps. If you read the dictionary version of mindfulness, they would tell you that mindfulness is about present state awareness. And it's two things when we think present state awareness. It's both what's happening within me and what's happening within the environment.
Mm-hmm.
So through mindfulness techniques, we can help people to be more observant of both of those things, what's happening here and what's happening in the environment that I work in.
Yeah, no, that makes perfect sense because when I first think of mindfulness in business, I think of, I guess, the employees to be able to be, first of all, really present and be mm-hmm. really aware of what they're doing and not distracted by what's going on in their everyday lives to just be able to, I guess, maximize productivity,
yes.
but also to increase their ability to engage fully in their role mm-hmm. and hopefully enjoy it.
Yeah,
because absolutely. You know, you can have a really tough day at work, or you can, or a tough day at home, come into the workplace, and if you can push all those sort of outside influences away, you can actually create, you know, a third of your day is actually going to be quite great if the issue continues when you return
home. I get my eyebrows done at this particular eyebrow bar every month, and they do an exceptional job of brows, but they have terrible customer service. The actual experience is lacking. And I often think I would love to teach these employees, they're all women, so let's say it, I'd like to teach these women how to be more mindful. Now, the reason I've assessed these people as not being mindful is they don't pay attention to their customer. They don't respond to their customer. They actually virtually ignore the customer. An example of that is one day I'd actually taken my son, his girlfriend, there as a treat. So that's $90. And they'd finished, and I was standing at the counter waiting to pay. The person who was standing at the counter was ignoring the clients around her, focusing on a telephone call. Now, for one, if I had have been the manager, I would have told her not to answer the telephone call because she had a long line of people in front of her. But secondly, I could have walked away at any point in that transaction, not paid, and she would never have noticed.
Right.
It's that, okay, you can or you can't answer that telephone, but make eye contact with the people around you just to reassure them that you know that they're there.
That's right.
And create an experience. Yeah, absolutely. So you're responding to your environment versus I'm assuming she had a bad day. It seems every time I go to this eyebrow bar, they all seem to be having a bad day. but if they learned how to be mindful, they could actually respond to the emotions going on inside them in a way that is productive and a way that actually makes them happier, but they'd also provide a better experience to their clients.
You know, I'm thinking about the situations. I wrote an article a long time ago about similar sort of experience in a hair salon, and look, these things happen in other industries, of course, but another example, and it was not dissimilar to that, but it was the conversations that one of the men was having, and he was actually, you know, how was your day? Great, I've only got an hour and a half to go. And I'm starting my, you know, experience, I guess, which I don't give myself very often. And I just thought, like, I know it's a normal conversation to have, but I think mindfulness in an example like that is really important, because it's sending a vibe. And depending on how people react, I mean, I didn't say anything. I thought, well, he's, you know, he's young and that's fine. And, you know, but I'm sure the employer would be not so pleased if they were actually there to hear that. And so I would think that it would go a long way, especially in the industries where you do have a lot of conversation when you're with someone for a long period of time in particular. Or even in those little short moments, like you're saying, someone at the counter, you might only have a 30-second, 10-second interaction with them, but that's what sticks.
Absolutely.
So you either get that feeling or you don't.
And I walked away from that transaction feeling ripped off. Now, we'd actually received the product we'd paid for, and they all did a great job at the actual brow wax, but I walked away feeling that I didn't have a good experience, and I had to actually be mindful and remind myself that I wasn't paying for the experience, I was paying for the eyebrow wax. However,
oh, I would disagree.
Exactly. I'm looking for somewhere else to get my eyebrows done. So if any of your clients are in Melbourne and they'd like a new customer, because I only go there because they do a good job, not because they make me feel good.
So the differentiator for you is that, well, I know there are other brow places that will do just as great a job. There has to be.
Yes.
But I'm looking for that. Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So, and I think with mindfulness as well, it is about happiness essentially. And that's where I think if you were to compare me to another productivity consultant, I have a very strong emphasis on happiness. Because happiness leads to productivity. Now, productivity also leads to happiness. So the company that the brand that I lead, have been around for 10 years. I've been only leading the brand for the last 18 months.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for 10 years, the company and all of the coaches within the company knew that the coaching that we provide helps people to be happy because they have a greater sense of control over all of the things that they have to do, you know, all of the busyness. And, of course, they achieve greater results after working with us. So, you know, you've got to be happy about that.
Yeah.
And because they have a greater sense of control over their work environment, they're also happier at home. They leave the work environment and because they feel they've both put in a good day and they have control over their work, when they come home, they're happier, they're more tolerant with their children because they're more, as an example, because they're more tolerant with their children actually behave better.
So it's a flow-on effect.
Yeah, a knock-on effect. So we always knew that productivity led to happiness. But when I took over the brand 18 months ago, I did some research and our brand is owned by a recruitment company, so I have access to full database of over 100,000 people, and I put together a survey, sent it out to everyone. Now, when we came back and we looked at that research, what we actually found was that the people who identified as being happy at work actually had better habits. So then those people who are happy were more likely to be successful. And the correlation between the two was just over 20%, might have been 24%, but it was if you were happy at work, you were 24% more likely to be productive than someone who's neutral.
Right.
If you're productive at work, you're 12% more likely to be happy than someone who's not productive. So therefore, happiness leads to productivity twice as much as productivity leads to happiness. So happiness leads to success. Now, this is just my survey. And while I worked with one of the universities on this research, I'm not a scientist, right? So we then went out and we had a look at other research that had been done globally, and they found exactly the same thing. The return on investment in investing in the happiness of your staff has been measured, and it's around $6 return for every $1 that you spend investing in the happiness of your staff. So it's not just a nice thing to do, and to be frank, that's why I do it, because I get a lot of happiness out of helping people change their lives. It's more than that. It's actually a commercial decision to invest in the happiness of your people.
So it's not just about creating a happy environment. It's so much further down the line than that. You know, I'm thinking back to your example before, and I'm thinking about environments where I've experienced similar service, and let's say, you know, hospitality is one of them, retail is another. It can happen in all sorts of service businesses. I would think that the biggest obstacle to happiness in the workplace might be overwhelm.
Yes.
You know, feeling overwhelmed, and you know that's why there's no eye contact while they're on the phone. You know, think about in a restaurant situation where they're avoiding eye contact because chef's shouting, and you know they're running around. That overwhelm is what actually puts the barrier to happiness creates that barrier to being able to deliver a great customer experience.
Yeah.
What do you?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a technique that I teach people, and it's called the mindful minute.
The mindful minute, yeah.
And I don't know if I stole that from someone, so I won't claim it as mine, but I did. The technique is mine.
Yes.
The mindful minute is really about taking a minute out of your day and just stopping and just for 1 minute, just closing your eyes, focusing on your breath. You don't even have to close your eyes. Just focus on your breath for 1 minute. If you don't have a minute, 30 seconds. It's a very short period of time. Now, that's enough to take your brain from reactive into responsive. Because when you're overwhelmed, what happens? My heart rate goes up. My breathing goes up. I have this sense, and sometimes I overheat. So yes. My body has a reaction. Now, when I stop and for a minute, I don't control my breath. I just observe my breath. Just observe it coming in and going out. And when you start to observe your breath, you'll actually know that automatically, or you'll see that automatically, it slows down. So my breath slows down, my heart rate slows down, this overheating that I get because I'm stressed, it starts to slow down, I start to cool down. All you need is a minute to refocus you from that place where you're not making eye contact with clients to, okay, why am I here? I'm here to serve these people. Let me do that. And you'll make the next right decision.
Okay, so that sounds completely like a great idea, but I'm thinking about situations where in my businesses I've had people under high pressure. You can't walk out of a kitchen for a minute because it's going
to
throw everyone out.
You don't need to walk out of the kitchen.
So you stand there.
No one would notice. And you don't even have to stop doing what you're doing, right? So you're making whatever you're making. My husband's a chef. I'm a terrible cook.
Well, that's a nice balance. Yeah.
But I used to go into one of the restaurants that he managed, and I'd make the guacamole. That's probably it's the only thing I know how to make well.
Mm-hmm.
So
it's a good thing to know.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I know too, there's a bit of muscle memory there. We kind of know what we're doing. Even when you're doing the dishes, that's not that hard, but it's hard for me. But whatever it is, right? Instead of engaging, talking to people, stressing out for a second, all I do is observe my breath. My hands are still doing what I'm doing. I'm still producing, but I just stop for a second, focus on my breath, 20 seconds. People don't notice. I recalibrate and then I respond rather than react.
Okay.
You can do it. You don't need to do it in a minute. You can do it in 20 seconds. I say a minute because a minute is that period of time that it's long but it's short. And it's enough just to take you from reactive back to responsive.
Now, I'm thinking, would there be any value? I'm thinking of how I would apply this if I still had my other business, which was a restaurant.
Yes.
And let's say, someone else has got a service-based business. Let's say we're talking about a staff meeting and we want to bring this up. Look, we know that everyone's trying really hard, but they're getting overwhelmed in the, pressure of the situation because for whatever reason, there can be those moments. And during that time, we can observe that we're not actually delivering or it's impacting on the customer experience. Would there be any value in sitting around at a table and actually having this sort of conversation around, so tell me when those moments happen and how are you feeling and how does it present for you? And, these are sort of personal sort of conversations, so they might be difficult to have.
Well, you may not do that in a team meeting. You may have that conversation one-on-one.
Okay.
Different people respond to different ways of communicating. But let's go back to the habit loop. So remember we talked before about you have a trigger, you have an action, you have a reward.
Mm-hmm.
So the trigger is actually I'm feeling my heart rate beat. I know that I'm really stressed. I may even start shaking, because you're that stressed.
Mm-hmm.
So the trigger usually when that happens is panic, right?
Yes.
this is happening. What taking that minute would do, so the trigger is I'm stressing. The new action, instead of stressing more, I remind myself, I'm going to take a minute for mindfulness. Now, if you can stop, say you're a server in a restaurant, and if you can stop just for a second and just stand in one place and observe your breathing, great. If you can't...
Go and stand in the cold room.
Yeah, exactly. While you're doing what you do, do what you have to do to actually just take your focus off stressing out about what's about to happen or stressing out about what just happened, is just take yourself back to that present state awareness of I'm here, I'm in this restaurant, I'm observing my breath, observe it coming in, observe it going out.
Mm-hmm.
20 seconds, I'd say aim for a minute. Now, if you were doing that in a team environment, so you're encouraging everyone to try this technique, I would recommend that you have some kind of code, and it might be, hey, I'm just going to take a mindful minute.
Yes.
And then the other people around will say, yeah, sure, support you to just stand in the corner, do your thing, ignore you, let you do your thing, and then you get back into it.
Yeah.
So it's really that 1 minute just to get back into where am I, what am I doing?
No, and I know I had chefs who did that.
Yes.
And it was good because it just sort of reset things. And it's like, well, they know they've still got to get everything out, everything's still got to roll, so definitely productive. All right, let's talk a little bit more about then happiness and productivity.
Mm-hmm.
So what can we do to create happiness other than being mindful and being aware and minimizing our frustration or anger or overwhelm? What do you suggest people do to create that happiness and to create the culture that will just have the consequence of being happy, but also the benefit of being extra productive on top.
Well, look, the first thing to do is start it at the very start and hire happy people. You know, instead of teaching people how to smile, hire people who already have great attitudes. I don't know if you remember from the book with Tony Hsieh, the concept that he talks about is he doesn't hire people and then tell them what their values are. He hires people that they already represent the values. So instead of doing what he tells them to do, they do what they would naturally do anyway, and that's serve customers. If we go back to that idea around creating that customer experience, I would tell you that not everyone is meant to be in customer service.
Mm, you know? Sure.
It all comes down to motivation and whether you actually like doing that. So hire people who like.
So do you have any suggestions for how people can do that? Because people have got their game face on. They want a job, and they, you know, potentially some people can't see that they won't be great in that. You know, they might think that this is a perfect environment for me. How do you then weed that out and determine that?
Yeah, absolutely. Good question. Well, candidates lie, right?
So yeah, well, employers. Everyone puts their best face on, naturally. Sure.
So
maybe not lie, maybe just bend the truth a little bit.
Yeah. Oh, well, I worked in recruitment for a long time, and that was the first thing that I learned in recruitment. My first day, I was told, first rule of recruitment, candidates lie. Second rule in recruitment, clients lie.
Oh, okay.
It was an optimistic future.
Right. Interesting workplace culture.
Yeah. Actually, really interesting. I didn't stay in that job very long. So if we could draw something else. So let's draw three circles. When you're hiring someone, and I'm drawing it for you, Mel, but if everyone can draw themselves a Venn diagram where we have three circles all colliding with a single point. And the first circle is about motivation. So motivation is around those things that you like to do. So if I were to interview you and I'd be trying to find out if you have the appropriate motivation to do the job that I want you to do, work with my client base and do that in a way that represents my values, I would ask you, what do you like to do? What did you like most in your last position? What did you like least in your last position? And I'd actually go through your resume and ask you that question about every single job, because the picture that that would paint is by the end of going through your background and assuming that you're not hiring someone straight out of high school, we'd have to use a different technique there, you will have a clear picture of what this person likes and what they don't like. And that's what you're looking for. You're looking for alignment.
Mm.
You're looking for them to identify that the things that they like are things that you can offer.
Mm.
Now, there will be some things that they don't like that might be in the job, but if it's the majority of the job, they're the wrong person for the job.
Sure.
Yeah. So really honing in on that motivation. Next comes the personal characteristics. So personal characteristics are the things that make me me. So something that makes me, for instance, is I like people. And I think I'm pretty good with people. Whereas our accountant, and he won't mind me saying this, he doesn't like people, but he doesn't like dealing with people.
Sure. He likes doing his job.
Yeah. He's a numbers guy. He absolutely loves numbers and he's exceptional at it, but he doesn't like people. So in our office, he's actually in the corner.
Okay.
He loves it that way. He faces a wall. And so that's what you want to identify. You want to identify what people's natural strengths are. And those natural strengths, again, should be the types of strengths that will work well within your environment, within your culture, with your clients, etc., or your customers. Now, the third circle is background and skills. Now, background and skills are all of those things that you've learned that you then apply to the job. So a chef, of course, needs to learn how to cook. Barista needs to learn how to make coffee. They're actually things that can be trained.
Yes.
Now, what most people do is they look at your background and skills. They look to see, you know, what you've done, where you've worked, and if you can do the job. So if you've got the competency required. But those things can be learned. So if I've got a waiter, I'm not going to say chef because they have a particular skill. But say I've got a waiter who worked at insert similar restaurant to my restaurant here, and then another waiter who worked maybe in a restaurant that's not quite, doesn't have quite the level of clientele or or maybe just not as prestigious as my restaurant, but they've worked somewhere else. And on the surface, the person who's worked in a similar restaurant would probably be better. But if he didn't love his job or she didn't love her job and they didn't demonstrate the strengths that I want someone to demonstrate, those things can't be learned.
Mm.
If this other person over here has experience which isn't quite as good, but they're motivated, they're excited by the opportunity to work with me, they love doing everything that I need them to do, then they're the right person. Now, when I say they love doing everything that I want them to do, they can lie about that, right? They can say, oh, I love doing X, Y, and Z.
Mm.
But when I ask them, what did you love doing in your last job? Unless they've listened to this podcast and they know the secret, it's very hard to manipulate those types of answers.
Yeah. You know? And they'll either come quite quickly, I imagine, exactly. Or they've really got to think about it.
Yeah. And in an interview, you ask the same questions in different ways because using that repetitive questioning technique, people can't lie forever.
Mm.
And the more that you drill down and the more that you dig, the more lies come unraveled. So the trick is not just asking one question. The trick is asking one question and probing into it.
Mm, okay, great. So hiring happy people is how you start.
Yeah, number one.
Great. Yeah. So let's say you've got that.
Yes.
And for whatever reason, whether it be, you know, external influences, mm-hmm. and you're just seeing that there's a change in culture, because, you know, sometimes new people can enter and that can affect the culture,
mm-hmm. yep.
or for instance there could be a downturn in business and then people are fearful of their positions, or there's some sort of question mark mm-hmm. over the stability of the business or any of those other things.
Yes.
What can you do as a business owner to be able to say, okay, I want my team to be happy, you know, I could take them out on a social event, I could mm-hmm. be doing some sort of team building, what other sort of things are going to generate happiness in the everyday as well as those, I guess, unique yeah. experiences?
Yeah, absolutely. And look, all of those things are great. It really comes down to investing in happiness. So if I were coaching your staff individually, for instance, I would encourage them to prioritize their happiness in their personal life. As an example, a way someone might do that, I'll tell you what I do and how I invest in my happiness is I front load my day. So before I get to work, I have been to the gym and I've had breakfast with my husband and I've meditated. So those three things make me happy.
Mm.
And again, within the work environment, creating opportunities to give that person what makes them happy. For instance, within our environment, we encourage people to exercise.
Yes.
On their breaks or exercise together. We also create social opportunities for people to spend time together, which don't necessarily involve alcohol.
Yeah.
And the reason for that is when we're creating a productive culture, if we just think that we're going to put on drinks on a Friday, which the company I work for, we always have drinks on a Friday if we feel like it, then what will happen at those drinks is I'll talk to the people that I would have spoken to anyway because we are similar and we get on socially, but I may not necessarily speak to someone who's different to me because, you know, we don't really have much in common.
Sure.
But if we create a social activity which forces me to work with that other person that I don't necessarily work with or I wouldn't necessarily choose to drink with, then we have to get to know each other and get that understanding of each other that we wouldn't necessarily get. And what the outcome is we're more likely to be productive at work because we've now understand the strengths of each other and we can feed off those strengths.
So my next question then is, how do you do that? Because let's say you've got a social day and you say, okay, we want you to, you know, go and stand next to someone who you don't normally talk to in your day.
Yeah.
I've been in those situations before and a lot of people sit there and go, oh, really, okay, and they sort of a negative start to the, you know, all right, okay, here we go sort of situation.
Yes.
What do you do to combat that? And, you know, do you set it up by... You know, do you tell people beforehand?
You can. Absolutely. If I think about the successful events that I've had with our team, it happens both by chance and by design. So recently we had a charity day at RSPCA, and the people who worked together were just allocated to different areas. One of our managers actually mentioned to me afterwards, he was designated to an area with our office manager, who's a complete introvert.
Mm-hmm. You
know? She's 21, he must be close to 40. There's no reason they'd normally get to know each other.
Sure.
But because they were in they were given that particular challenge, I think they painted some office or something like that.
Okay.
That gave them the opportunity to work together. But I think if we broke down what that looked like, it was they had an outcome they needed to achieve, and they were put in a situation where they had to work together to achieve it. And through naturally working out and problem solving together, they were able to learn more about each other.
Mm.
Another example is I used to play netball with a team of colleagues. Now, within the actual business that we worked for, I was one of the more senior operators in that business. So on a regular basis, I would probably have delegated to certain staff members in the team. And because of my seniority, I always try and ask and always try and influence and get the right result. But a lot of the time they would do things simply because of my seniority.
Sure.
Now, I'm actually terrible at netball. Absolutely terrible.
Okay.
Not very sporty at all. On the sports field, I'm no longer the person with power. It's actually the more junior people in our work environment who were exceptional. And so through learning to play netball together, I had to learn to take instructions from them.
You know? Right.
And they also had to learn to be leaders as well.
So it balances things out a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely.
So the day at the RSPCA, was that a paid day, or was that a day where your staff were encouraged to go on, you know, say a weekend or...
No, it was a paid day.
It was a paid day.
Yeah, so yeah. It's an investment that we made.
Yeah, okay. And so there'd be real value in, you know, actually using that paid day to really make an impact. And how often a year would you suggest for a small business to be investing in something like that?
Look, most companies who do charity days, as an example, will do it once a year, and that's provided to staff as a benefit.
Right.
So when, you know, when you're offered your salary and your holidays, a charity day is actually part of the contract.
Right.
Now, that's actually not the case for us. We just every now and then we'll decide to do something. Everyone contributes and we do it. So we don't actually personally have formal arrangements, but previous employers I've worked for have.
Right.
In terms of having some kind of social interaction where people can get to know each other, I would suggest once a quarter.
Yes.
So it's a great opportunity to celebrate your results. And it may not be a whole day you take out. It might just be, say, a couple of hours. You go off-site and do something together, even if it's, you know, play a soccer game or whatever.
Yeah.
But just giving people opportunities to naturally work on problems, work together in ways that they wouldn't normally work together. They develop other strengths.
Okay. All right. Sounds good. I'm just thinking about all the opportunities that are out there, and I'm thinking of people I know that do that with their staff, and they, you know, I think stand-up paddleboarding was something recently.
Yes.
And then I guess there's always the worry that, say, someone has a fear of being in the open water or, you're not open water, but out in the water or something like that. So you do have to take things like that into consideration to make sure that it doesn't become a stressful
consult. I actually saw this woman, but I caught up with a previous colleague for dinner last night, and we didn't talk about it at the time, but we had done a team activity, and part of that activity, it was like a race across the around the world.
Oh, you know, fun. Orienteering sort of race.
It was a cross between Survivor, Race Around the World. It was amazing. It was in just near SeaWorld. Is it Corran Cove?
I'm not sure.
Near SeaWorld. But
Sanctuary Cove.
And we ran all across this island, and one particular part of the challenge was riding bikes. Now, she'd never ridden a bike ever before in her life.
Right.
And so we got one of those double bikes. She was at the back. Someone else was at the front. She didn't even know to pedal.
Right. You know?
But that's the definition of teamwork. Someone else who's good at something is bringing someone else along who's not good at something.
Yeah.
And I always remember that because I had so much respect for her that day that she was humble and she got on the bike.
Gave it a go. Yeah. Very good. Okay, so let's talk about rewarding. I mean, what's your thoughts on rewarding staff in a financial way to do that as well? Is that something that, have you done any research around that?
Look, when it comes to culture, if we go back to what we're looking to achieve, and it's probably a good idea to define culture. The way that culture is defined, and there's so many explanations out there that I just find confusing, which is one of the reasons why people do become so confused about what this thing culture means. Culture is basically how things are done. So when we're talking about rewarding staff, quite often people forget to reward people based on how they want things done. Now, an example would be quite often salespeople are rewarded with bonuses based on their financial results.
Yes.
And companies that have salespeople and reward salespeople based on their financial result often struggle to get the salesperson to perhaps get their admin done or fulfill certain compliance obligations or sometimes just interact with the team and demonstrate the right behaviours. Now, you can talk to those salespeople until you're blue in the face, but unless you're rewarding them for their admin, for their compliance, for the way that they behave in the work environment, you're fighting a losing battle. Now, I don't go out in the structure reward programs, but what I do say when I am coaching my clients is make sure that the behaviour that you want to reward is the behaviour that represents how you want people to behave. You know, so fine, reward the salesperson based on sales. That's the inherent requirement of their job, but also reward them based on compliance, admin, the way they behave in the workplace as well.
All the other essentials that might not be the end goal, but they're integral in the process of things.
Yeah, but, you know, of course, first you want to try and hire the salesperson who just does that naturally anyway. You know, it all starts at the hiring process, so try and hire well.
Mm. Okay, so let's talk about tracking productivity increases and tracking happiness.
Yep.
And
yep.
on a basic level to get started, what would you suggest business owners do to gauge where they're at now to be able to sort of put some processes into place and so that they can actually look back? And what sort of timeframes are we talking about to realistically be able to determine whether there is a reasonable improvement?
Yeah absolutely. So let's go back to habit change. Now, I don't know if you've ever heard the saying, it takes 21 days to change a habit. It's not true.
No, I did read about this. Yes. It's something like 66 days or something,
significantly more. A lot more. It's somewhere between 3 months and 8 months.
Okay.
You know, and it's different for different people. It's different for different habits. But essentially what we're doing is we're actually training our brain to think that the habit is now just what we do normally. Now, when we're trying to change a habit, something called the lizard brain and the amygdala will try and stop us from doing whatever we're trying to do. Now, it doesn't know what we're trying to do is actually good for us. What it's just thinking is that's change. Change risks me dying. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to sabotage this change. Now, when your clients or your customers are looking to change a habit, need to understand that it's going to take some time. Now, when you're looking at how you're going to measure that, what I would say is measure it in a way that is means something to you. So it's going to be different for everyone. But what you would do is you'd think, okay, Let's pretend we're working together because that's the easiest way for me to tell a story, right?
Yeah.
So when I start working with someone and my coaching programs that I run across usually 6 modules.
Yes.
So my first meeting with my client, we determine how we're going to measure success. So that I ask them to think about the end of the program. Sometimes we work together for 2 months, sometimes we work together for 6 months. But I'll say in 6 months' time, if you are productive and happy, what will that look like for you? What tangible ways will you measure success? And it's going to be different for different people. Mm. For some people, it's just revenue. You know, I want to see an uptake on revenue. And we see at least an uptick in revenue of around 20%.
So that's a great result.
Yeah, so because we help them free up an extra, usually an extra day a week, they then realise that in revenue. But for some people, it's things like, I want to work less hours. Someone I'm working with at the moment works 80 hours per week. He's got three children and a wife at home. He wants to work 40 hours per week. So at the end of the program, we'll look at how many hours he's working. For some people, they just don't want to work weekends. Other people, they want to achieve their compliance results. So it's different things for different people.
Yeah, no, that's great. But being specific rather than just, I want our group to be happier and I want us to be... Yeah, so it doesn't. Yeah. It's not always about the financial, but being able to be specific
something
around
that you can measure.
Yeah,
absolutely. And again, different things for different people. So, yeah. So to answer your question, just think of yourself at a future state, what you want to achieve, how you're going to measure it, and then we work back and we look at what are the habits that we need to change to get there. So while we're sharing things, the performance equation that I work towards is high performance is equals efficiency times effectiveness.
So can you say that again?
High performance equals efficiency times effectiveness. And when I'm doing a keynote speech, I'll ask people to actually give themselves a score. So efficiency is how you do things.
Yes.
An example of something that I'm very efficient at is booking travel. I'm so good at it, Mel. Someone should pay me to do it.
Right.
I get the best possible airline, best possible time, get that booked, get the hotel booked, best possible hotel, best possible price. I've got a driving service in most capitals in Australia. I can nail it.
So that's you're effective.
I'm efficient.
You're efficient.
I'm very efficient at it. And I also put it in my calendar, all of the information's there. So I'm very efficient at it. However, I shouldn't be doing that. Why am I booking travel? That's not my job. I'm actually better to be focused on things which make money for my business.
Sure.
Better to be focused on my people, my clients. I've got an admin person who can book travel. Now she probably doesn't do it quite as well as me. Sometimes she might forget to put it in my diary, etc. But that's, that's an opportunity cost, right?
Yes.
It's the reverse of an opportunity cost. That time is better spent by her, and I need to teach her how to be more efficient. So that's where efficiency, the how we do things, is great, and changing your habits makes you more efficient. But the effectiveness side is making sure that you're doing the right things and that you're identifying what you need to be doing to produce the result that you need.
Right. Okay.
Sorry. And I know I spoke over you then. You're about to ask.
No. I'm just trying to... I really am having to think through the efficient over effective because I was getting a little bit tricked up there because I'm thinking, okay, it's about being able to do something but being able to do it in a timely manner. But it's not. It's actually about going, is this the best use of my time? Can it be done to still get the same outcome as what I need?
Yeah.
And if it can, well, then it absolutely needs to be passed down the line because otherwise, like you say, you do the 80-hour week.
Absolutely.
And I think this is a common complaint of business owners is that, I have to do all these things by myself or I can do it my way and I can't trust anybody else. And it's a genuine feeling.
Absolutely.
But it is a mind shift, isn't it? Mindset shift to be able to...
Yeah. Where should I spend my time? So there's a few things. One is delegation, and I think that is something that most people struggle with. And you'll hear them say why they don't delegate is because the other people don't do it as well as I do. So I talk to people about the rule of three in delegation. So I know if I delegate, let's say my travel, I delegate my travel to our office manager, Georgia, who is exceptional. But I the first time she does it, she'll probably do it 50% as well as I would have done it.
Mm-hmm.
So I give her, travel's probably a bad example. Let's give another example. I've asked her to write some content for my client. So I ask her to do that. I tell her what I want, how I want it, when I want it, why I want it. So I delegate that well, give her all the appropriate detail. She gives it back to me and it's only 50% right in terms of the standard that I would have achieved is... it's half as good, So I get out my red pen and I coach her on how it can be improved and I ask her to improve it. Now, most people don't do that. What they'll do is they'll get it back. It's only half as good as they would have done. They've gone, oh, no one gets this right.
Just as I suspected.
No one's as smart as me. Why did I even waste my time? You haven't invested enough time yet. You've got to give it back to Georgia. Ask Georgia to do it again. Now, she gives it back to me again, and she's only got it 80% right. Now, again, I don't accept 80%. I take out my red pen. I fix it up. I give her some coaching. I ask her to do it again. The third time she gives it back to me, it may not be 100% right, but it'll probably be like 95, 98% right. Now, that first investment in my time, it might have taken three times as long. So I've got to build that into my week, you know. I've got to know if I'm going to delegate this to Georgia the first time, it may take me 3 days to get it right, whereas normally it would have taken me an hour. But now, every time that particular task comes out, I don't have to worry about it. Georgia can do it. So it's an investment, you know. And that's why most people don't delegate well. They just don't give it enough of an investment.
Yeah. So I'll let that, what did you call it, the rule of three, was it?
The rule of three.
Yeah.
Yeah. So okay. Give it three times. If after three times they still can't do it, it probably means that person doesn't have the competency or the capability to do it, and you need to find someone else to do it.
Yeah.
You know, don't take it back. Just find someone else to delegate to.
Yeah. No, I'm guilty of that. Well and truly, even I think about, you know, even with editing of the podcast and things like that, I've been through those stages and it's like, oh, no, I need to do it because I need to make sure that I'm happy with it and all those other things. But it's still the labour and the time not really well spent for me. So I'm going to take your advice there.
Excellent.
release of the responsibilities. Okay, so we talked about a couple of those pillars that you were talking about. You normally work on six, you said.
Six, yes.
And let's talk about, let's finish up actually, because we need to wrap this up, and you've given us a huge amount of information to think about and to be able to move forward. And I know that your articles are really fantastic, great food for thought, and definitely some actionable, definitely lots of actionable things in that content. So if people want to follow you and find out more about the sort of work that you do and how they can be helping, you know, increase happiness and productivity in their workplaces, where can they do that?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'd say go to our website. So have a look at I didn't have to say the triple W, did I? PackExecutive.com. So that's PackExecutive.com. Did I spell that right? I hope I did. Yeah, Pack Executive.
Pretty close. Pack Executive.
Now, if you'd like to see my writing, and I do produce a lot of content around productivity and happiness, go to the newsroom. That's where all of my blogs are, and I produce a newsletter on a regular basis. At the moment, it's once a week. I'm about to move it to once a fortnight. And you can subscribe to the newsletter anywhere from that website as well. It's just up in the top right-hand corner, I think. Now, because you've inspired me to be more customer-focused and to look after people who are in hospitality and retail and service-based businesses, we have put together a package which are actually four of the six modules. And what I've done is I've taken out the content that is only really relevant to corporates. And so those four modules start off with habit change. We talk about procrastination, mindfulness and managing your energy, and then planning. And I'll put a link to that particular package for your clients on the front page of the website.
Excellent. So you can check that out. And if you didn't catch the name, all of the details will be in the show notes. That's at customercentriccoach.com/52, because we'll be episode 52.
Lucky 52.
Yeah. Thanks for joining us, Shalina. Really great to have you here. And I've just got so much to think about now. It's great.
Well, you better be happier and more productive by the time I see
you
again.
Oh, yes, please. Let's do it. It's going to be how many days of habit? 3 months, 6 months?
3 to 8 months. Yeah. It's worth it.
Absolutely. Turn things around. Change your life. Absolutely.
Today's episode was recorded at the Corner Office in the Brisbane CBD. They are positioned at 483 Adelaide Street. Beautiful meeting rooms and lounge bar there for you to have a look at. Really worth your while. Check them out online at thecorneroffice.club. Well, that's for episode 52, done and dusted. And look, I really enjoyed having a chat to Shalina about all things productivity and happiness. You know, there's lots of talk around happiness at the moment, and it's because we're facing lots of different stresses in our lives. Mental health issues are more prevalent than ever in business and in regular life. So it's something that's really worth investing in. It's not something that's airy-fairy. So really glad that we got to have that chat with Shalina today. Now, folks, if you're finding these episodes to be helpful to you, and hopefully you are, if you're not, please let me know, because we are looking to do everything we can to help small businesses keep their customers, get more of them, increase their profits, and give themselves more freedom. And if it's not what it's achieving, then I want to hear about it. But if it is, then we would love to hear your positive reviews and ratings on iTunes. What that does for us is it helps boost our listing where we sit on iTunes, meaning that more people will be able to access information like this great information shared today. So leave us a rating and a review. We'd be very grateful. But always, please contact me if you'd like to give me some feedback, give me some advice on who you want to hear on the show. Please do that. You can email me directly, mel@customercentriccoach.com. I would love to hear from you. Enjoy the rest of your day, and we will see you back next week for episode 53. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for listening to the Customer Centric Show. For additional smart ways to attract more customers, profits, and freedom, head on over to the website www.customercentricshow.com.